Welcome to the WBGO Journal. I'm Doug Doyle. Today, WBGO's Brian Delp chats with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and MSNBC host Jonathan Capehart about his new memoir.
I had no expectations. I just wanted to get this book out.
WBGO's Dave Popkin caught up with award-winning blues guitarist and singer-songwriter Samantha Fish before she taped a PBS show at Iridium.
I've been watching PBS since I was a kid, and I've been exposed to, you know, so many great artists and like great music on PBS. So to have the opportunity to perform and to have a show as a part of that lineup, I'm very proud.
And film critic Harlan Jacobson reviews Jurassic World Rebirth.
In Jurassic World Rebirth, new archetypal characters from the dinosaur world Crichton left behind have been put to different use by Indiana Jones franchise writer David Cope.
All this coming up today on the WBGO Journal. When Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Jonathan Capehart first launched NBC's The Sunday Show 4 years ago, he got very emotional and thanked his family and NBC News for their never-ending support of his work. Now Capehart's new memoir, Yet Here I Am, Lessons from a Black Man's Search for Home, is already on the New York Times bestsellers list. He recently spoke with WBGO's Drive Time host, Brian Delp.
Jonathan Capehart, welcome to WBGO, or actually welcome back, because I know you've been on with Jay Johnson before.
Yes. Oh, Brian, thank you very much. This is a huge treat for me.
Well, we're here to catch up socially and to talk about this outstanding new book, your autobiography, your memoir that has just been released, I guess, in the last 2 months. In the last month. I know I had it within a week of its publication. But Yet Here I Am, Lessons from a Black Man's Search for Home, Jonathan Capehart's outstanding new memoir. Congratulations, by the way. I know that it's going very well, and it's already made the New York Times bestseller nonfiction list, correct?
Yes, it has. And thank you very much. People have been asking me, you know, about the book tour and how's it going? Has it met your expectations? And I've told them I had no expectations. I just wanted to get this book out. And so if one person bought the book and said, you know, I read it and it's helped me in some way, that would be worth everything. But man, when I got word that we made the New York Times bestseller list after the first week, I mean, I didn't have that on my bingo card at all. Not at all.
I wouldn't describe your childhood really as peripatetic, although you did grow up in different places. You started like in Academy Spires, right here in downtown New York, went to Hazlitt, which was a completely different experience down the shore, came back to live with your stepfather and go to St. Benedict's Prep. Mm-hmm. So how was that shaping you as a person?
There I am in Hazlitt. And this is folks have to understand, this was the 80s.
Right.
And so it was, you know, the years of the Preppy Handbook and Izod Lacoste and popped collars. And so when we were in Hazlitt, you know, my mom played tennis and I picked that up from her. So I played tennis every day. I dressed tennis wise. And then when they told me, when my mother and then soon to be at that time stepfather told me they were getting married, I was like, wait, what? And we're what? Moving back to Newark? Oh, no. And so I said to them, you know, congratulations, but y'all are going to have to find me a private school to go to because I'll get beat up. I said, I'll get beat up in Newark public schools. So a teacher at Raritan High School, I told her what was happening. And she told me, have you heard of St. Benedict's Prep? And I hadn't. She finagled an interview for me. I got in. And the chapter in the book that sort of talks about this transition from, you know, predominantly white suburb where I was the only one in the classroom or one of a few in the school back to Newark. The title of that chapter is Fresh Prince in Reverse.
Right.
And it was as if, you know, the Fresh Prince's cousin, Carlton, had moved from Beverly Hills or Bel Air to Newark. And so even though, you know, I'm a black kid and, you know, I listened to, at the time, to WBLS and have black family and relatives, I moved to a predominantly black and brown city and completely not knowing what to do, how to fit in. And I tell a story about how my then stepfather looked at me in my tennis whites and popped collar and said to me, you can't leave the house dressed like that. And I defied them. And I'm not going to give away the story. You just have to read the story in the book.
After Carleton College, you went on to a variety of positions. You worked for WNYC, our sister station, right across the river. It was a fairly large leap, although you had been an intern on the Today Show. From there, all of a sudden, you went to the New York Daily News, which is astounding to me. But on the other hand, I think that's what made you the writer that you are now.
Yeah, that was the leap, Brian. You know, I always wanted to be, since I was a kid, I called it news commentator. Mm-hmm. And so folks can read in the book how I got the internship at the Today Show. So when I left WNYC and went back to the Today Show as a researcher, you know, I knew by then that folks in television love to hire people from print because they know how to think and they know how to write.
Yes.
And so when the Daily News called, the Daily News op-ed editor called me, Bob Laird, and he said, you know, I got your name from Tom Morgan, who was the president of WNYC and a Carleton class of 49. And he said, you know, I have the perfect person for you to call, Jonathan Capehart, but he's having too much fun at NBC. And when Bob Laird told me this, I said, yeah, Tom is right. Thanks for calling. Goodbye. They had an open editorial writer position. And so I told my mother and my then partner at the time separately what happened. And they both said the exact same words. Are you nuts? Call him back. You don't even know what the job is. So I did. I got the job. And I thought I would stay there for 2 years, learn how to think, learn how to write, and then go back to the Today Show. And instead, I stayed. And I learned, I mean, Arthur Brown and Michael Goodwin were the editorial page editor and deputy editor. And they told me during the interview, if you want to learn how to write commentary, write opinion, this is perfect. You are raw clay. We'll teach you. And great. I'm right. All for it. And it was a fabulous experience.
Well, it was a little better than a fabulous experience, Jonathan. You ended up winning the Pulitzer Prize, which is, you know, nothing to sneeze at.
No, you are right, Brian. but again, you know, just sort of like with this book where I had no expectations of, you know, like the New York Times bestseller list. When it came to the Apollo Theater, all we wanted to do was to help save the theater, help turn it around. And
Which we did.
And I will never forget Randy Daniels. He pulled me aside, former CBS television journalist, said to me, you know, you guys are going to win the Pulitzer Prize for this. And I looked at him with this, I gave him side eyes. And I was like, you are nuts.
and yet,
it turned out to be right.
Here we are. We're talking about it 25 years later, right?
Yeah, almost. And I write about the day we got the secret phone call that we had won. It's one of those indelible moments that I was really happy to get down on paper, just to bring people inside of what it's like to go from just working on something because you care about it and you're trying to do good, to then getting, in journalism at least, print journalism, the ultimate recognition.
You know, you being a native of Newark, New Jersey, you know, this radio station, WBGO, has really been a part of your life, has it not?
Oh, absolutely. But before I get to talking about BGO, I just want to say that for people to understand that chapter about why I left the editorial board, you really have to read the entire book. It puts that chapter into much needed context. But, you know, WBGO is, talk about home.
Yes.
WBGO is home wherever I am in the world. I mean, you and I really got to talking when I was in Rome. And it's six years ago next month, I left for Rome for a month to write what eventually became this book. And because Rome is 6 hours ahead, I would turn it on and you were doing jazz overnight.
That's right.
And just the music that I would go on these long walks in the morning and I would have jazz overnight on. And the music that really hit me while I was on those walks, I would note them. And I created a playlist, Rome 2019, which I still play. And so for me, this station is home, no matter when I turn it on, no matter who is on, although I have my favorites, Brian.
you said that to Jay Johnson, you know, when he had you on 3 years ago, and I thought, oh Lord, I'll never hear the end of this. And now that brings us to, you know, I'm reading the final chapter, you know, of this book, and I get to page 252, and you say it right there. Thank you, Brian Delp, for your playlist, you know, inspiring me while I was in Rome in 2019. I was floored. I didn't expect that ever.
You can see Brian Delp's entire conversation with Jonathan Capehart on the WBGO YouTube channel.
In WBGO Studios, we are on site at Iridium in New York with an artist who has won dozens of major blues awards. Her last album with Jesse Dayton was nominated for a Grammy, and her recent release, Paper Doll, could be headed in that direction. Tonight, she'll tape a TV special for PBS. On August 16th, she's coming to Jersey, Morristown Jazz and Blues Festival. It is my pleasure to welcome Samantha Fish. Thanks for doing this.
Hey, thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Is there a special significance to you personally that you're doing something on PBS?
Absolutely. I mean, I've been watching PBS since I was a kid, and I've been exposed to, you know, so many great artists and like great music on PBS. So to have the opportunity to perform and to have a show as a part of that lineup, I'm very proud.
The new record is great. A lot of your signature stinging guitar on it and the great vocals. Sweet Southern Sounds is one that stands out. There's also some heartfelt, thoughtful lyrics on this record. You co-wrote the album. How much of it is autobiographical?
Quite a bit. I write a lot from personal experience and just, you know, if it's not something currently happening, it's something I've experienced in the past. The idea with storytelling or songwriting is storytelling, you know, and you want to tell other people's stories. So I might be writing from a personal experience, but I'm trying to write something that's also universal and can connect to other people. And, you know, you don't want to get so specific that nobody can relate. Some of it is autobiographical and then some of it is storytelling.
I saw you interviewed somewhere and you were talking about COVID and how you were stuck at home and doing your Friday night things. And did that change your writing in the way that you do it?
Absolutely. Yeah. I had never done a Zoom writing session until COVID. And now I do it all the time. It was, you know, in some ways we learned a couple new tricks, you know, because now I can do anything from anywhere. There's no more procrastination. I can have a writing session whenever, wherever, with whoever. But yeah, I definitely took that forward on this record because I was on the road for the recording process, but also for the writing process. So when I was collaborating and, you know, working with others, I mostly did it in, through that method.
One of the songs that you just soundchecked downstairs is the first song on the record, I'm Done Running. It's really about running emotionally, but you also are on the run all the time, physically, internationally. When you go home, can you settle in or do you get the itch that like, I have to go back out?
It's a momentum thing. You know, I have a couple days of freaking out when I go home because your body and your mind, you're so used to being in this constant state of routine and movement. So when I go home, I have like anxiety is usually the thing I feel the most. Like the first couple days, it takes me a while to unwind. But now that I've done this a long time, I'm better at recognizing, oh, this is that, you know, this is stopping. This is what it feels like. And it usually takes me about a week to kind of relax and get into this other mode because you really have to change gears.
When I look in the mirror at who's staring back at me, the world's not getting clearer, but it's easier to see. I'm turning into someone that I've never known. Past is coming undone, but I like where I am going. I know I'm changing, changing.
Still in New Orleans?
Yeah, I love it there.
It's so great. Music on every corner at all hours, right? Yeah. Sometimes in listening to you over the course of your career, it seems like there's an angel on one shoulder and a devil on the other shoulder, and they're like battling it out, right? In a heavyweight fight. Who's winning lately?
Oh, God. Well, if we're still making records, like, and the material is not all sunshine and roses, then I guess the devil one might be winning a little bit, but... No, I think that speaks to everybody. You know, we have a little bit of that push and pull in us at all times, you know, but I think that's what makes for interesting music, right?
It does. And speaking of interesting music, some of my favorite stuff that you've done is like the Dap Kings-esque stuff. Amy Winehouse, Sharon Jones, were they a big thing for you coming up, their vocal style?
Oh, yeah. And I love soul singers. So like, I think the record you're speaking to is Chills and Fever. And that record was definitely inspired by Detroit and you know, soul bands, and every song on that record was a cover that if it wasn't a hit it should have been, you know, like it just had all the makings for it. There was so many of those soul songs that kind of didn't quite get the attention they deserved, you know, so that was really the reason I wanted to record that record. But yeah, absolutely, I love Sharon Jones and, you know, Amy Winehouse. I love Aretha and I love Betty LaVette and Betty Harris and you know, wanted to pay homage to some of those great singers.
I've seen that the Rolling Stones were a huge thing for you growing up and you got to open up for them recently. What was that like?
Humbling and exciting and an honor, really. Like a great, huge, like massive honor. Every interview I've ever done where they ask the question, who do you want to open for? I'd ironically say the Stones because I didn't think in a million years that would ever happen. So to get that opportunity was, you know, it's just like a mountaintop for somebody opening a show. They sounded amazing and it was just a great honor.
Samantha Fish is with us here. Were there any artists early in your career, you know, you're young, you're growing up, it's Kansas City, that kind of took you under their wing or gave you advice or put you on a big bill that like really sent you on your way?
I mean, I grew up in Kansas City. There were a lot of local bands like Trampled Underfoot and Levittown who were, you know, really, really great and exposed me to, you know, Kansas City audience. And then, you know, Mike Zito ended up producing my record, introduced me to Roof Records. Tab Benoit, I'd gone on the road with him some, and I met him through my manager, Ruben Williams. And that's what I love about, you know, Kansas City. There's a lot of help, you know, like people really want to help the younger crowd coming up. And I definitely had a lot of support. And, you know, and also in the blues in general, I think there's kind of this, you know, camaraderie. And I definitely had a lot of love, you know, back then, and try to pay it forward now.
It's Samantha Fish. She will be in Morristown, New Jersey, a free show, Jazz and Blues Festival. That's August 16th. Check her local listings for her PBS special. Terrific album, Paper Doll, is out now. That is Samantha Fish here on WBGO.
Summer films this time around have shown some mettle at the box office, and the Minecraft movie, which tapped into the 12-year-old psyche like nothing else, was the undisputed king of spring, earning $425 million at the U.S. box office. Our film critic Harlan Jacobson has a few thoughts about a Dinosaur Challenger opening this 4th of July weekend.
Jurassic World Rebirth is the seventh in the franchise that began in 1993 when book and screenplay author Michael Crichton, a native of Roslyn, Long Island, had just turned 50. Having much earlier discarded his Harvard Med School degree for a burgeoning career of sound the techno alarm entertainments, Crichton saw two more Jurassic sequels, Lost World in 1997 and Jurassic Park 3 4 years later, before he died at 66 of lymphoma in 2008. Almost all the Jurassics hinge on a truism of classic education. Tampering with nature is hubris and will not end well. This one is brought to you by producer Frank Marshall in collaboration with Steven Spielberg's Amblin Entertainment, plus the usual visual crew of thousands, and with Alexandre Desplats importing significant bars from John Williams' horn-driven original soundtrack to make us feel right at home. In Jurassic World Rebirth, new archetypal characters from the dinosaur world Crichton left behind have been put to different use by Indiana Jones franchise writer David Cope. Cope's outing here for director Gareth Edwards is nominally about the greed of Big Pharma, but mostly about Scarlett Johansson showing no fear in the face of dinosaurs. Johansson plays Zora Bennett, a crack mercenary adventuress hired by Big Pharma baddie Martin Krebs to go to an off-the-grid Caribbean island where genetically engineered dino mutants from the previous installments of the series are waiting for their close-ups. Scarlett's mission is to extract live blood samples from the dinos to turn over to Big Pharma to develop a surefire cardio drug that will make the company trillions, doing good for rich people doing bad. The target dinos include one mad raptor bird, one big ocean thing, and a Tyrannosaurus Rex knockoff bigger than Macy's. Zora, the team leader, will get a $10 million payday, which screenwriter Cope, in a Hollywood writer fantasy, leverages into a $20 million gambit sequence to split with her trusty crew. Johansson plays Zora not quite in the weary aging gunfighter mold, but more as she is, a 40-year-old bred for a higher calling who went rogue to escape office drudgery. Scarlett seems to know the fantasy of one last job to exit the mercenary gig. We spend the first couple of beats of the 2-hour, 14-minute film with Scarlett, Zora, assembling the team. Jonathan Bailey, fresh from his Lord Anthony Bridgerton British TV gig, here as Loomis, the earnest paleontologist at the Museum of Natural History, forced to close up his department due to public boredom with dinosaurs. Also slumming from a high-profile British career, Rupert Friend plays Martin Krebs, the obligatory bad big pharma guy, given a pencil-thin mustache and almost a flashing neon banner rolling across his forehead that says, "Weasel," all caps. And Mahershala Ali is Duncan Kincaid, a former mercenary pal of Scarlet, putting on a big happy face to hide a bad personal loss. Now with a fishing boat living out Jimmy Buffett's dream with a touch of boredom somewhere in the Caribbean.
On the island we're headed to, 24 species have survived there alone.
The theme park owners did experimental work, leaving only the worst ones here.
The motley crew sets sail, but en route intersects with a divorced Mexican-American dad, played by Manuel Garcia Rulfo from The Lincoln Lawyer, sailing the world with his two girls and one of their callow boyfriends who've wandered into the forbidden dino zone. Their job in the script is to mirror the Mallflex audience, which you can hear in the line Cope gives one of the kids after their first Tyrannosaurus Rex encounter. Mom won't let you take us for a vacation again. Smart Scarlet plays Zora, the bounding, leaping, shooting, and always thinking mission specialist, as she calls herself, rather unconvincingly, as if it's been a while since she's been in touch with anyone as nice as paleontologist Loomis. He whispers the professionally unthinkable to her, checking her ethics at the door and executing her mission to turn the dino blood over to an open-source lab to make a cardio drug, you know, for the people. One of my closest friends happens to be an expert on the process of drugs making it through development, trials, and FDA approval, and says it's a minimum $100 million investment. Loomis either glosses over that detail to the mercenary Zora or has no clue. But no matter, Scarlet Zora is faced with the decision to stop doing bad crap for money and get clean. Perhaps that explains how Scarlet, who knows how to use her eyes, conveys the irony here. Big job like Jurassic World sets her up to direct her first film, Eleanor the Great, about a firecracker old Jewish lady that debuted in Cannes last month. Scarlet knows how to scrape the bark off a dinosaur. You can read the whole of Jurassic World Rebirth as a political action plan if you like. Well-educated Gen Y gets into a dogfight with boomer dinosaurs. Make of that what you will. The true dinosaur was preordained in Cope's genre formula script as the American corporate male's indefatigable hubris of messing around with Mother Nature for profit. Audiences can tune out CNN for a couple hours to rehearse surviving 100-foot-high boomer mutants that snatch helicopters out of the sky and eat them, which they do, not to mention product placements for Snickers and one of the potato chip companies, I forget which. Gotta hand it to Jeep, which inked a TV ad deal with the production to use a Jeep off-roading around the dinosaurs in the jungle. Imagine what that will do for sales to our weekend warriors, you can hear them thinking in Toledo Jeep headquarters in my old hometown. Alas, the Jeep in the film appears to the Tyrannosaurus Rex cast in the film, after the usual intense round of auditions, of course, as just another cocktail weenie in a bun. Crunch down on that one, too. This turn of the screw doesn't seem like it's the Jeep's transmission so much as the usual driver error. You'd think the head guy at Jeep Toledo would have had the guy on retainer in Hollywood check out the script. He'll no doubt be reassigned back to Toledo after the film opens this July 4th weekend, absolutely everywhere. And I'm Harlan Jacobson.
Thanks for listening to the WBGO Journal. I'm Doug Doyle. Join us next Saturday morning at 5:30 for another edition of the award-winning WBGO Journal. In the meantime, stay tuned to the world's greatest jazz and blues station, WBGO and WBGO.org.